Everyone, welcome to the Fairbanks City Council regular work session this Tuesday, April 8th, 2025 at 7 a.m. Madam Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Mayor Pruse.
I am here.
Mr. Cleworth.
Here.
Ms. Therrien.
Here.
Ms. Sprinkle.
Here.
Ms. Tidwell.
Here.
Mr. Marnie.
I'm here.
Mr. Ringstad.
Here.
Okay, before we go on, just let you know that my health isn't the best this morning, suffering from a cold, so my disposition might be nasty.
No.
Yes. Yes. So with that in mind, Mr. Sanders will be answering most of the questions on what we have here. Because I'm being broadcasted live. Okay, item number one, ordinance 6312. An ordinance amending Fairbanks General Code Section 14-333, rotation tow list eligibility requirements, and amending city's tow rotation list, schedule of fees and charges of services advanced to April 14th. So we've had a first reading on it. Mike, you want to bring us through this, please?
Yes, sir. No changes since last time. It's a we've had changes to the fee schedule. That's where most of the changes are. There is one change on the ordinance itself, and that's under on the first page under A number 4, that we want to have our impound lot to be within a 10 driving miles distance of Fairbanks City Hall. That includes most of the businesses that are already serving us. And we did have one complaint about that. It was from a company out of Moose Creek that wants to continue to be on the rotational tow. But we have had complaints about folks that want to get their stuff, and they have to drive all the way to Moose Creek to get their stuff. They're already down a vehicle because it was in an accident or whatever. I was talking to the owners. I told them that that's the only complaint we've had with them. If they were to have something closer to town, that they would be fine. And they seemed to understand that. Other than that, the fee schedule itself had not been changed in 5 years. We reached out to the industry to see what fees made sense, what fees did not make sense. Some of the ones that they wanted included, we at the staff level took them out. We figured they seemed excessive. The rest of it is probably on par with what they would get.
Any questions? Mr. Marnie, then Ms. Sprinkle.
Well, the cleanup fee, is this $100, that additional to the towing, or?
Yes, that's additional. Right now, one of the problems that we have, and everybody complains about this, is the tow companies are leaving stuff there, and they're like we're not paid to do it. Other than like Interior and Badger, they both do a good job, but a lot of the other tow companies are like, we're not getting paid to do this, so we're not going to do it. So.
And they're diligent enough to go back, and once the police department calls them and says, hey, you got to clean up.
Right.
They're good about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Ms. Sprinkle.
So I'm just looking at the list of call-outs. We've eliminated all of them except just one, and everything's going to be $300. Is that what I'm seeing here?
Yes.
Because we had it a discriminate pound. I guess I'm just wondering why that was ever there anyway.
We were the only ones that had that, so they're not sure where that. We're not sure exactly where that came from. We're talking to folks about that, and they said that that this is closer to what the troopers and others use. So
if I had an accident and I called my own tow truck, are they going to cost $300? That seems like a lot.
No, it's going to be a lot more if you call your own. But this is limiting limiting what the tow companies can do, not increasing.
Okay, yeah. Just checking. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. No.
Anything else? Mr. Cleworth.
We still have one company that we use when they don't request somebody, or we're doing an impound or something like that. Isn't that correct? Who is that? Who is that company?
Interior currently has our main contract. This is for the rotational tow, but Interior does have our main contract, and they were fine with these changes.
So. Yeah. How many companies are on that rotation list now?
I think we're at 4 or 5 right now. Interior. Yeah, I believe 4 right now.
Ms. Tidwell.
When do we use, like, the rotational versus
just interior?
Let's say that there was a wreck, and the police officers asked the vehicle owners if they have a preference, and they say they don't have a preference. That's when our rotational tow list kicks in.
Or on a Saturday night when they're transported to the hospital, and there is no one to direct it. So, anything else? Miss Therian, that's... Thank you for letting us know. Okay, seeing nothing else, we're going to move on. Chief, come on up. Fire department fees. Mike, go ahead and lead us off on this.
I'm just kidding.
Go ahead, Chief.
Good morning, Mayor. Hope you're feeling better. Good morning, Council. So some of the things that are in front of you, our yearly maintenance things that we do for our fee schedule inside of the fire department, so kind of situation normal. I will point out that these are just the changes to the current language, so not every line item that's in the fire department fee schedule is notated on the piece of paper that's hopefully in front of you. These are just the changes that I'm recommending to the council. So if the council pleases, I can go line by line, or if you just want to pick out specific sections, whichever is better for you, Mr. Mayor, I'll do it either way.
However you want to present it, sir.
I'll just go down the list, then. That way we can just all be on the same page. So the first part is our yearly maintenance of our ambulance fee schedule. I changed a couple of the wording, like for the per mile section, where it's going to say per loaded mile. So that way we're actually specifically carving out the loaded mileage, which is what we're legally allowed to charge for. That fee is, and these are all based off of CMS changes for fees at the federal level, that what we're allowed to charge for this area of Alaska. This is a best practice move. So the ambulance per mile fee is going to change from 16 to 22. That's the recommendation. Basic life support is going to go from $1,000 to $1,170. Advanced life support transports are going from $1,300 to $1,382. I know that's a huge number. I know. I'm recommending that we remove the citizen discount for residents. I've spoke to this before. This is a huge time killer for me to go through each individual run. I've read over 30,000 runs since I started working here, fun fact. But to go in and try to figure out who is a resident and who isn't as simple as it seems on paper. I would guesstimate that 85% of the runs that I read, each individual has up to 3 to 4 addresses just in that run. So they'll have an address on our driver's license that doesn't match the address we picked them up at, that doesn't match the address that's on their hospital face sheet, and that doesn't match the address that they actually told our providers. So I have 4 or more addresses for every run that I have to go through and try to say, do they actually live here? Were they just picked up here? Does this address actually constitute being a residence or not? And it's a process. It sounds kind of ridiculous, but it really is hard to narrow this down so this fee gets applied correctly and universally fair to all the residents and non-residents. It's a lot of work because almost everyone we pick up has multiple addresses on file, and there's no way after the fact for me to easily figure out, is this your current address? As you may be aware, some people don't keep their driver's licenses up to date. And it's almost a roll of the dice. And I don't want to be wrong, because I do want people to get the credit that they deserve. But for the $100 difference, I don't feel like per hour it's really helping out the city or the citizen, to be honest. So I recommend that we remove that discount and maybe look at a different way to do that in the future. But when you add 30, 40 minutes to each run over 30,000 runs, that's a large chunk of anyone's time to try to sort that out. And I'm not convinced that it's 100% accurate because of those multiple addresses that I run into. The next line down, we're changing the language to be more clear for our vendors and customers out there at the fire code compliance / inspection reporting fee, which we currently use the Bricer compliance engine for. That fee is changing based off of some of their increases. Now, this is a pass-through with a small increase, and a small percentage of that comes back to the city directly. It's just a few dollars that we actually get at the end of it. On your form, I think it says $15 or $20. That got updated late yesterday, and I apologize for that not being on your form. That charge is now going to be recommended at $30. So if you can make that note on your form in front of you, I would appreciate that. When we first started this a couple of years ago, the council will remember that this is a pass-through that the contractors will put through to the customer who's getting the plan review or the inspection done. And this is a fee that this company charges them to insert that into their software. A couple of years ago, the council wanted to have the base fee for Bricer, on top of that, a small city fee, just so the processing, you know, actually benefits the city in a small way. Like I said, it's a few dollar difference, so it's not a time consuming or big issue. All of our contractors have taken to this with little to no objection. Other services in the area use the Bricer compliance engine, so we're just kind of following suit. This is a huge force multiplier for my fire prevention division that is, up until yesterday, a one-person show. This gives them an automated system in the background that alerts us to different violations and code issues automatically, and it doesn't require them to go dig through files and spend hours trying to figure out where these inspections and violations ended up at. So for the contractor, it makes it a smooth process to get that information to us, and for our end, it gives us a good repository that's easy to search, dig through, and find. So although there is a charge for that service, it's fairly nominal when you're looking at, you know, the overall picture that some of these companies are working with, and it's worked tremendously well. And this is, like I said, just a bump in their fees, because I don't think any fees are going down in any company anywhere. So we're just trying to make sure that we're not losing money on that transaction. So the next one's probably the most substantial change. If you remember, 2.5, 3 years ago now, the council worked very hard on in changing and adopting and working on the fire inspection, investigation, and technical service section of the code, or the fee schedule, I should say. And although it made it a very short and concise paragraph, and I appreciate the hard work that everybody put into that, operationally for the last year and a half or so, it's become very hard to administer, because although that wording works for inspections pretty well, it does not cover plan review, re-inspections, and other things that we actually do on a regular basis. So like for technical plan reviews, for instance, it doesn't make sense, since we farm that out to a third-party company currently. They charge us per hour, period, right? If they look at it for 4 hours, they charge us for 4 hours. They send back recommendations. Our current language says that that first re-review will be free, right? Because it says your first inspection, we charge for first re-inspection, is free. Since this doesn't speak specifically to plan review, our only course is to let that second one go through free, because that's what the language speaks to. And we get another $400 or $500 bill for that second review, and we have no way to recoup that cost. So we're losing per hour necessarily, but we're losing period on all plan reviews right now. So that really spared me to go in and just try to clear this up and make it more user-friendly for everybody, and our customers and contractors alike. So right now we have a $125 per hour kind of flat fee for everything. It all got rolled into one paragraph. My recommendation on the page in front of you is to break this down by type of inspection to a point, but not to get overly ridiculous like some other jurisdictions did. I did a lot of homework on this. I worked very hard to make this simple, not overbearing to any individual or company, but to also make it make sense. So a big chunk of what we do is in-home and other type of daycare settings. I feel like $125 for an hour or less inspection was a little steep for a daycare. So I looked at some other municipalities in Alaska, like Anchorage and other areas that are deferred jurisdictions. And I kind of looked at other areas across the nation that I feel do things the right way. And they break this down by size of daycare, and I think that makes a lot of sense. So my recommendation is that we switch this to, if it's a less than an 8-child licensed daycare facility, that it's going to be a $50 fee, because they're usually pretty quick. They're usually easy and compliant, and $125 to spend 30 minutes in a building seemed to be a little rough. The bigger daycares obviously require more time. They're a little bit more work. So I recommend that we do a $75 fee for a daycare facility that has more than 8 children in it. And then we're going to look at all general inspections after that we do, which, you know, can encompass any and all commercial buildings, you know, hood re-inspections, all the other things that we do. Because of our time, because of the fact that, you know, we have costs that we need to cover, and I think the council is very aware of financial situations, and this is my pitch trying to help from the fire department side the best we can, is to go from $125 per hour for these other inspections up to $180 per hour for our time that's in there, so hour for hour, with a one-hour minimum charge, right, as it was in the past. Then looking at re-inspections, that's where we find a deficiency or a violation, and we say you have 30 days, 90 days, 100 days, whatever it is, to get that fixed. The first re-inspection is going to be $125 for that inspection. You might ask yourself, why is that less than the initial cost? Re-inspections are usually quicker because we went from a whole facility down to one or two, hopefully one or two problems, so they're usually quick, right? You go in, did you fix the two problems, check the box, and we're done with it. So we wanted to give them, one, we need to cover our time for being there, but two, to give that business owner a break for, hey, you worked hard, you did, you were compliant. We're going to get in and out of your hair very quickly. Second re-inspection, they still haven't corrected the violation, so we've had to go out there another time. This is where almost every jurisdiction that I know of will start putting additional fees on to try and gain compliance from the consumer or the business owner or whoever it is, because some companies have enough that they'll just pay $125 forever and not fix the bigger problem. So I jumped that to $350 for a second inspection. And then the third and subsequent inspection, so you're just not compliant and you don't want to play the game, will be $600. And then through other processes with the building official and the code, if they're still just willfully uncompliant at that point, we can continue to charge that fee every time we go out, or look at stricter rules and, you know, movements from either the building official or the council to get that building under compliance and back online like they should be. I know several meetings ago, probably the last time we changed this, there was some concern about complaints. Well, what if I just don't like so-and-so, and I'm just going to call the fire marshal and say, hey, their building's jacked up, so therefore we go out there continuously, and in theory costs them a lot of money. So we did go in and define a complaint, hopefully well enough that it makes sense that we're not just going to take anonymous complaints. I think that those are easy to shoot out and not have any backbone to it. So if you're going to complain, you have to be specific. It has to be in either writing, email, or direct complaint received by the city, where we'll also gather that information. And then we're going to go out and we're going to check that violation or that complaint to make sure that it's either valid or not. If we do not find a violation, that business will not be charged. That's not fair to them that just some random person called, made a complaint, and we're going to go out there and try and collect a fee for it. If that complaint is valid, then we're going to work with that business owner. But fees would apply at that point. Hey, they were right. Your sprinkler system is broken. We need to get that under compliance because that's a safety issue. So hopefully when you read through that language, it'll make sense of what we were trying to accomplish. And then I don't know if it's on the same page or the back page for you. Because of pass-through monies from the state for cannabis and alcohol licenses, that's part of their licensing fee from what I understand. So we would go out and do that first time, once a year inspection to cover that license fee for nothing. But if we find issues and we go back, then our normal fee schedule would apply, right? The state only covers enough, barely enough, in my opinion, for us to go out there one time. And if that business has several issues or violations, then obviously we'd have to go back and spend more time than that license covers. So that's where the biggest chunk of that change happened, and hopefully that makes sense now. The next section really kind of got lost in the last translation of that paragraph. Fire plan drawing and technical reviews. We're currently working on getting at least one, if not both, of our DFMs now certified to do plan review in-house. Currently, we have a contract with Design Alaska, and like I said kind of earlier, they charge us per hour for that plan review. So some of these plans are very technical. They take a lot of time. They can be several hours of work on their end. And they charge us every hour like clockwork, no questions asked. Because the current language has that one free redo kind of language in there, I wanted to break this out and make sure that it was separated, and then break down the fee, kind of showing you my future thoughts for it. So right now, if we send over a four-hour plan review, we lose about 3 hours worth of time that we're paying for directly as a city to them. Our $125 an hour fee doesn't even come close to their junior architect or engineers per hour cost. So we, by rule, can only charge $125. They're charging us $180, $190, $300, depending on who actually looks at the fee. So we're losing that right off the top, and I want to make sure that we're not losing money for that. I don't know we want to make, you know, turn it into a huge profitable business to do plan review, but it hurts every time we see a bill come in and our fee covers a quarter of it. And then here we go back down the rabbit hole of we're not actually helping balance our budget out. So my recommendation is to take that out and make it its own subsection. I'm recommending $450 per hour for that plan review, and that builds in a couple of things, $180 for the city fee and a $230 per hour fee from the third-party vendor, which currently is Design Alaska. My future plan is when we have an internal plan reviewer is to drop that to the $180 per hour fee for the city side. This way, it's a true wash, right? We're not going to make any. We're not going to lose any. If the council is interested in pulling a little bit in revenue-wise for that, we can always bump that up a little bit. But I feel that that accurately represents the time and energy. Since we're a deferred jurisdiction, we get that plan review directly dropped in our lap, which means our fire marshal does have to touch it. They do have to look at that plan. They have to make sure it's actually in the city limit because we get plans for places that aren't in the city limits. So we have to do some groundwork. So that's why I felt the city fee was important to keep in there. Once we do the background work and we send it to Design Alaska, I just want to make sure we're breaking even with Design Alaska. That's exactly a break-even cost for us overall. And then with the kindness from the council and all the hard work that's going into the fire training center, and some future projects that we hope to get done at the fire training center, I think our current fee structure for that was woefully inadequate to try to reboost the hard work and money that the city's put into that. At the same time, I don't want to price us out of the market completely where we have a nice facility that nobody wants to rent because it costs too much. Currently, we have it broken down into $70 or $40 for a four-hour block. So $70 gets you 4 hours. And, you know, per hour, that's a good deal, I think, overall. I think that once we have all that work done and the 16,000 feet of cat cable that's been put in there and all these other changes we're doing, I don't think it'll be unreasonable to raise those up. So I recommend $400 for a four-hour block for the tower and ground. So that'll get you the training site, the tower, the burn room, that whole little parking lot, for lack of a better term, in the back. The large classroom, which will be the only functional classroom once the backup PSAP center and the 911 training center is done, we'll only have one classroom for fire classes, $225 for a four-hour block, and I'm just taking out that extra $40 charge that's in there for the smaller classroom or conference room, because that's going to be 100% off limits for non-city staff or non-dispatch staff to be in, so that just needs to get striked out. So I know that was a lot. I was trying to go quick so it didn't take 16 hours to go through, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Thurian.
I was just wondering whether these increases is going to keep people from wanting to use that facility.
I don't think so. I think right now our biggest issue is the lack of updating to that facility. When you break that down, you know, it seems like a lot, $400, but that's, you know, $100 per hour.
Okay.
So it gives you a four-hour block, and then $225 also gives you a four-hour block. This is something that I've seen in other training centers that seems pretty reasonable for the size and future quality of our training center. I would not want to charge that for its current state. I think I would feel pretty bad about that. But I think with Mike's vision, my vision, and the council's help, that's going to be a very nice, high-quality training center when we're done with it. And I think $100 or less per hour to use those facilities is fairly reasonable. If market value dictates differently and we find out that, you know, that's not okay, I'll gladly come back to the council and see. Like I said, these are recommendations, and the good news is we can adjust these on the fly. It just takes a quick chit-chat and a meeting, and we can change this. I think this is fair for the quality of building that it's going to be. Not in its current state, though, but that's going to be, I think, a premier training facility in the area, if not the whole state.
I had one other question, Mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to the fire plans.
Yes.
Is it possible that we could just charge whatever Design Alaska charges plus our city fee, as opposed to guessing what they're going to be charging us?
We can. The $230 covers all of their different levels. They have different seniorities, they call it. It's just, you know, how long they've been with the firm, basically. We can do that. I went with just a flat rate, so that way the construction folks, the contractors, the people who are getting this work done, they know what it's going to cost, so they can bid that project correctly. The problem is if we do that after the fact, they may have undercharged for that. If the senior engineer looks at it, Design Alaska, it's going to cost us more. If a junior engineer looks at it, it'll cost them less. But I feel like if I was owning that contractor company and I went to Mr. Marnie and he said, hey, I need this built, I'm going to try to get him an exact cost to bid off of, we wouldn't be able to do that because until we send it over there, we don't know which partner is going to get the work.
I thought you said it could be as much as 180 to 300, but you think?
I was trying to split the hair a little bit. I want this this will cover all the costs with the city fee. Obviously, we're at 450 per hour with that. So we may lose a little bit more overall. We may gain just a little bit percentage-wise, but it's very small. I was really trying to be as fair to the contractors as possible so that way they're not walking into a big project saying, well, the materials are going to cost you this, the labor is going to cost you this, the plan review is going to cost you, we don't know, right?
Okay.
Now, that was my thought process, so hopefully that makes sense overall. And like I said, once we bring it in-house, it'll be much easier to control that cost because we know exactly what that cost is going to be.
And one more.
Go ahead.
If somebody makes a complaint and we have to go in and inspect and there was no grounds for that complaint, could we charge them for our inspection?
I think that gets very tricky because complaints can come from anyone and anywhere. I think if we do that, it might punish someone who's trying to do the right thing, who just maybe doesn't fully understand the rules or the code. And I don't want to punish people for trying to do the right thing. I don't want to punish people for calling 911. I don't want to punish people for saying, hey, that just doesn't look right. Can you guys go check it out? We don't get a ton of complaints since I've worked here. I think the best way to handle that is just to, you know, call it no harm, no foul, and just kind of go out. Because we're going to take specific complaints. So we're not going to, if someone complained at a huge facility, we're not going to go through every inch of that facility until it's time by code or law to go into that facility. So we're going to look at that specific problem. If somebody says, hey, their means of egress is blocked, we're going to go check that specific item, and either it's true or it's not true, and then I think that's where the fee should be applied. I think if we, you know, take your average citizen who's trying to do the right thing and slap a $125 charge, they're just going to be like, hey, it's, you know, whatever, it's not my building, I don't really care if somebody gets killed or hurt. So I'd rather have that information than that. If this council pleases, we can definitely look at that. My recommendation would be just to kind of call it a wash. And, you know, we found a complaint. We went out and resolved it one way or the other, and life kind of moved on.
Ms. Tidwell, then Ms. Sprinkle.
On the fire inspection section, like the fees for the re-inspections when they start to come into play, what's the process for that? Like if you go and inspect something and there is a violation, mm-hmm. Do you automatically go back? Do you go back like every 3 months until it's corrected, or what triggers that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we go to your building and there's no violations, that's a one and done, right? We'll charge you the 180 per hour, and then that's the last you see from us until your next regularly scheduled inspection comes up. If we do find a violation, fire code, local code gives us the ability to work with that business owner. So depending on what we find, how hard it is to correct, how hard it is to get parts for that system to get up here and get that work done, direction to my fire marshal crowd is to be as reasonable as possible, but to also put a date. So, I did an inspection recently at a local school. They had some minor corrections that needed to be done. We talked to the maintenance worker, and he said, I can get those done in about 30 days. So we have a reinspection coming up here shortly in 30 days. So we work with that business owner. Usually it's no sooner than 30 days unless it's literally something they can correct on site. Like if we find an extension cord that's in violation of the code and they unplug it and they throw it in the dumpster or whatever they do with it, they can correct some things immediately on site. But if we do have to come back, usually we give them at least 30 days. But if it's like a fire alarm panel and they have to get the parts from, you know, wherever, and it's going to take 3 months to get the parts, we can work with them and their contractor and say, hey, that part's going to be delivered in, you know, 5 weeks. Can you come back in 7 weeks and we'll make those adjustments? And the same process we repeat. If we go back for the first reinspection, there's still violations, we'll say, hey, you're still not compliant. What can we do to work with you to make this better? And then schedule out 30, 60 days again, and then we go back for a second. And if we get to a third, then we're at a much different situation. Usually that's a bigger problem, because if they're communicating with us, we should never get to that third reinspection, right? If they're like, hey, the part didn't show up, can we bump it out? Like, we want to work with our citizens and our business owners and our property owners, but we also want the city to be compliant with the International Fire Code and local codes as adopted by the council. And there's a balance, right? And we have to make that balance work out. So there's no hard line in the sand. Generally, we're within 30 to 60 days for first reinspections. That's kind of the normal. But we do have some projects that we know are going to take several months, and we adjust accordingly.
Ms. Sprinkle?
Have we ever had to have a real hard, stern talk about the reinspections, and someone, you said they would just pay the price?
Yeah, we when I first got hired, we had a troubled property in the city that went all the way to the building official having to shut that business down.
Okay, so that's where
those are few and far between, fortunately. Most folks that we run into are out of compliance, not on purpose. Sometimes they don't realize it because those codes are very technical, and they can be hard to manage unless you just live in that world. So
you, as the chief of the fire, you have to go through building to shut something down? You can't shut it down yourself?
That's correct. I don't have that power in the code. The building official is the only person.
I don't think that's
person.
True. I don't think that's true. But nonetheless,
I can evacuate, but that really doesn't work for these kind of things.
You can't condemn a building.
Condemning is one thing, but shutting down a business if you need to.
If it does not comply, it's the building official who does that.
All right, I'll follow up on that. Thank you. Last but not least, the training center. Is there janitorial involved in that rental agreement?
No, usually we rent that out to fire service folks who are good about cleaning up. However, when we do rent it out to someone for a civilian event, like a birthday party, which has happened, I think, maybe once in decades, they are told that they're responsible to police up the building afterward. And if it is, you know, in a disarray, we do have a process to go back and say, hey, you kind of trashed the building. What's going on? Fortunately, we don't have a lot of issues with that, since 90% of the people that are out there are fire service, and they take pretty decent care of the building when they're done with it. The worst we've ever seen is the dumpster being full, and we have a process to get that taken care of. So it's not – usually it's just the dumpster after a live burn or a lot of fire training where they have a lot of leftover product. They fill up our dumpster, but I think all of these things will make sense with the future plans and use for that building. I think that's a good question, but we haven't had enough where we've like, wow, they like went in and just destroyed the place. So we usually do a good job of, you know, having good people that do it for the right reasons. So,
Mr. Clearworth and Mr. Marnie.
Chief, thank you for this. My comments are kind of nitpicky here, and I apologize
for
that.
No, absolutely.
When I read anything that we're looking at, I look for the changes, and you say up above, changes are in red. And so when I look at the fire inspections and code compliance, that long section there in the middle, the only thing I see there in black is per hour, 1 hour minimum on the right side there. We don't really know what the original language was in that first column where it says fire inspections and code compliance. I assume that was the original language, but I don't know.
Right.
And then you go down to the next box below it, fire plan, drawing technical. We don't really know what the original language was or what we're getting rid of.
Yeah, there was no original language. The original version combined those sections in the current version, and I'm trying to break those back out. I did leave out the current language in the 30-1 through 30-31 section because this was already super long, and I didn't want to have hard objects coming at me too quick. So the current version, I think Danny has pulled up on the board, but I'll be glad to have that disseminated out as needed so you can compare that. I was trying to keep this as short of a document, and I failed because it's still a pretty long document. But
no, I appreciate that, but it's hard for us to really know what we're changing or not if we don't see that original language.
Madam Clerk?
Mr. Clearworth, I'll have that in proper form when it's introduced in a resolution. I'll make sure it follows the fee schedule form.
Okay, I appreciate that. And then last
question.
Thank
you, though. Good catch.
Maybe for staff or the administration, when we had our budget work sessions with the building department, they've talked about doing the plans inspection internally there, as you remember. And we brought that up at a council meeting some time ago. Is there any movement on changing that from fire to building or not?
Not yet.
I don't remember us ever saying that we're going to take the DFM work to the building. I might have missed that.
Yeah, I think there was a brief conversation about it. I haven't spoke to the building official about that. This is only clunky because we don't have a plan reviewer in place. We should have that corrected in the near future, and then it'll go to what normal authority deferred jurisdictions do is that we'll do our own plan review internally. Because this is very specific, and that will require a conversation with the building official if he has someone on staff that's even certified to do that plan review. I don't know that sitting here today. This is just an unfortunate combination of events that over the years, when our last plan reviewer left the city, we were unable up until recently to get traction to get a plan reviewer in place because we didn't have anyone that was going to be in that position long enough to do it. But right now, our DFM, Brian, is well on his way to being a plan reviewer, and our new hire, DFM, Dennis, who started yesterday, has 30 years of experience, and we just have to get his credentials sorted out at the state level. And like I said, I'm guessing by the end of the year, we'll be doing this all in-house anyway, and that kind of takes care of this third-party fee that's really the driving factor of a lot of these charges, so in that section anyway.
Well, I just want to emphasize, this is something we've talked about for decades, is one-stop shopping. And when the building department official mentioned that in his comments, I thought, well, good, maybe we're moving finally in that direction. For the consumer, for our customers, our people, it's a lot easier than to deal with two departments at the city. And if he has somebody that can be trained up to do that or is doing that, that just makes common sense, I think, to have it all in-house in one department. But I mean, Mike, you heard his comments when he gave his budget presentation. He elaborated on that quite a bit.
I think we must be thinking about different things. Like the fire marshal stuff is so specific to them. I think it'd be a stretch for that to all move over to the building. I mean, not to mention all the contract issues, but I don't think that the building official would be taking on the fire marshal roles.
It's just a plans inspection. It's not. I mean, you're just looking at fire code and seeing if they're compliant on it. I mean, just like building code, general building code for electrical or anything else.
Yeah, I'm at a loss on this one. I honestly don't remember that conversation. I would have thought that one would have stuck out.
Jerry, I'll take a look at this.
Yeah, just talk to them.
Yeah, and if it makes sense, I'll present it. Yeah. If it doesn't make sense, I'll still present it. That way we all know. That way we can form a direction to go on this, but it's a good thought. It's a very good thought. Mr. Marnie.
Well, I got two or three things. The guy that calls in and wants, you know, rats on somebody, or, you know, that guy. Do we at least get his information?
Currently, it's kind of an interesting complaint process. So
whenever you talk, the sirens go on.
We missed last meeting, Mr. Mayor, so I wanted to make sure that we had it happen this time.
Okay.
I don't know what happened last Monday, but we'll do better.
Please continue.
We'll work on that.
You're back in the saddle again.
Thanks for the question, Mr. Marnie. Currently, our complaint process isn't well-defined. It doesn't really say what a complaint is or isn't. We take all complaints very seriously, but right now, if they call in, the clerk may answer the phone, the admin may answer the phone, I may answer the phone, the DFM may get the call directly, and I'm sure that everyone has their own different thing. And the backside is when it's called in over the phone necessarily, if you say, hey, my name is, you know, Mr. Marnie, we have to take that for face value. So that's where we're really trying to get it in writing or an email from somebody to make it as legitimately backed as possible, even though everything can be duped and faked nowadays. I get that. And ChatGPT can probably do a great complaint if you ask it to. We're trying to do our best to make sure that we don't go out and ruffle feathers unnecessarily, but we do try to take complaints seriously. So if it seems valid and it seems like it's a real concern, we will go out and investigate or inspect that. And that's just part of the fire marshal business. We have to try to do our best to handle any complaints, so that way that citizen or that other entity is their concerns are taken care of, but also not unduly, you know, putting any extra pressure on property owners or business owners, and say, hey, we're coming out just because we got a phone call and we're going to charge you $180.
Well, I think it'd be great to do a follow-up, you know, that thank you for your call and your concern. The other thing is, I don't want to lose the resident discount. I think we, as residents of Fairbanks, need to have some kind of pennies. So I know.
I agree. I just don't know if the $100 is the best way to do that in the current process. But that's up to the council. If you want to continue that, this was merely my recommendation. Okay. Well, and I will continue to do as directed.
I know you will work on that. And the last thing is, I these numbers up for services, why can't we just round those off to something? It's, you know, 1382, that's a. Can we round it up to $1,400 or?
Absolutely, I can go back and make those adjustments. This is based off of it's kind of like buying a new car. There's new car math and there's CMS ambulance fee math, and that's right out of a calculator with the pennies rounded off. So if we like even numbers, the next version of this I'll shoot to Danny that has a nice, clear, concise number. This just maximizes our CMS possibilities for collection. So
thank you, Chief.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Ringstead.
Following Lonnie's little bit, when you first said that about how hard it is to find residency, makes me wonder about our clientele.
We have a very fluid population
I'm fairly
base.
Consistent. I think most of us are probably fairly consistent. We don't move weekly.
Fortunately, you don't call for ambulances either.
If you've got four different residences that you're claiming, are you really a resident anyway? I don't know how you verify that, but...
There's no common sense way to do it. I do the best that I can, and there's some that maybe get it that shouldn't, and there's some that probably don't get it that should, but it's physically, after the fact, impossible for me to go back and track that down. Half the phone numbers on hospital face sheets are fake, so I can't even try to call the person and say, hey, where are you at? Can I come see your house? Do you rent? Do you own? Are you in some kind of treatment facility? Where are you?
How much of a time interruption in your day is that?
That can add 20 to 30 minutes per review.
So
easily.
You're removing that time interruption by doing this.
Yes, and that's really where I'm coming at this from. It's not that I don't think residents deserve a break. Mm-hmm. I think for the 100, if you're looking at a $1,400 bill, and if I can figure where you live out, you're going to get $100 off. That's the part that I struggle with personally. Like I said, it's up to the council's direction. I'll be glad to continue either way.
Mr. Ringstead.
Just a thought.
So are those folks actually paying the bill?
Well.
I mean, if you're that transient, you know, do you have
probably
paying the bill anyway?
It depends. So the real interesting part to this, and I'm going to try and keep this concise, but EMS billing could be its own work session in and of itself. When you look at the majority of our payer base, they're Medicare, Medicaid, or a Native Association insurance, which follows rules that are very similar to Medicaid. A lot of this is kind of a moot point for those folks because by contractual allowances, once they pay whatever they're going to pay, we can't bill that person after that. The contract says whatever's remaining from that bill, you get to eat. Congratulations. Thanks for doing business with us. So then you subsect this down to our commercial payers, which is a very small segment of the people that we transport and take care of. Then that $100 fee could be beneficial. The issue is when billing companies look across all of their fees for us, they say, okay, well, Mr. Johnny, I hope there's no Mr. Johnny listening. It's just a fake name. I'm just kidding. I hope no one named Johnny gets sick or hurt today. You had a $1,400 bill, but another one of our customers got a $1,300 bill for very similar services. What's going on? And then they'll start to question it. They can start denying runs. There's weird little processes in the background. But for the majority of our payer group, they don't ever see that discount because the contracted allowance is hundreds of dollars below what the actual bill is. You can see a Medicaid bill for a $1,700 transport come back with a $200 payment, and that's the end of the discussion. There's no repercussions after that. So a lot of this time and effort we go into because we don't know what their insurance will or will not cover necessarily. But it does, I do kind of take that deep breath when I see an insurance company that has a contracted allowance built into their process, and I still have to go verify their residency the best I can, knowing good and well that we're never going to make it to that $100 discount because they're paying us pennies on the dollar.
We've been at this now on this for about 40 minutes, 35 minutes. It is now 7:45. Let's move on. Thank you, Chief. Yes, my disposition is
Thank you, Mayor. Thank
failing
you, Council.
Fast. That's this afternoon. Okay. Next is a discussion of HB 119 gas pipeline Fairbanks Spur. And Elena, why don't you come up too? And do we have Yuri available? And have Yuri bring us through this. Certainly.
John and I wanted to see if the council could come up with a decision with regard to this so we could have a resolution available for the Monday calendar so that when John and I go down, we can say the council agreed to.
Well, I'm the answer is yes. I'm putting, Madam Clerk, Mr. Attorney, resolution. Anyone else wants to join me?
Yeah.
The only question I have on this right now is, we don't have Senator Kawasaki on here. Mm-hmm. So are we going to get him on here, or is he opposed to this?
I'll find out.
Thank you, because you want to have all your interior delegates on this, and he's the only one who's missing. What's that? The Senate, we have a Senate companion bill with both Kronk and Myers. So, anyway, Yuri.
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I'm not sure why I can't see myself, but I'll proceed anyway. So House Bill 119 and the companion bill, Senate Bill 114. I don't know if you have these before you, but the language in these bills are basically the job description for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And all the bill does is add to that job description a requirement that the Fairbanks Spur Line be included in that work in advancing, specifically an in-state gas line. There's a general recognition that in order to benefit from gas from any major project, our community would need to build out the natural gas network, the mains and the service lines, and that costs money. I think I see Elena there, but she could confirm there's, you know, between $200 and $300 million worth of work that would need to go into development to get gas to the residents and the businesses and the industrial users. In addition, residents and those same commercial and industrial users would need to convert their heating systems over to natural gas, and those all, and the cost of those things would fall on the ratepayers and the consumers of that gas directly. And so, general recognition that adding the cost of what could be, you know, a couple $100 million to build a 32-mile gas line from the main line, which runs alongside or just outside the border of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, I guess actually runs through a couple miles of it, but for the most part runs along the other side of Murphy Dome. And to bring that in costs significant money and may ultimately put the cost of gas out of reach for a lot of folks. So the bill is an attempt to have that project cost amortized alongside the main line, which just AGDC recently announced an MOU with Glen Farm, who now owns 75% of that AK LNG project. And I guess we won't know for sure, or one way or the other, until the end of the calendar year, whether or not that will move forward under that arrangement between Glen Farm and AGDC. But anyway, these bills, working their way through the committee process, the House bill was heard last month. The Senate version was heard for the first time in Senate Resources yesterday. Testimony was received from IGU and the borough mayor and Fedco in both hearings. And I guess the question for city council is whether or not to support this concept or not. I know, I think Ms. Therrien and Mr. Ringsad do have plans to be in Juneau next week. We'll be making the rounds with our interior delegation members and other legislators as well. And this is one of the topics that will be sure to come up.
So, Yuri, this is on a 2-year program, this legislative session and next, to get this approved. Correct?
Correct. Yeah. These bills will be alive the remainder of this session and next. Yep.
Questions for Yuri. Ms. Tidwell.
I just wonder if you have any information adding this in. I mean, I obviously this is a great idea and I support it, but the fact that it's not part of the big plan now that has permitting, and this wouldn't have permitting because it's not part of that plan, does that really hold up the entire plan?
Actually, in answering that, I brought that entire conversation up with Senator Sullivan. And if you looked at President Trump's Alaska executive order, it takes permitting on this project down to less than a year. So also I look at this, you know, I've had discussions with my oldest brother who's part of ADA, and they wanted to, you know, his first thought was to have this make pure economic sense. My thought was, this will never make pure economic sense. What makes economic sense is what they're doing here, attach it to the main line. This is a $200 to $300 million cost on a $50 to $70 billion project. So this addition is less than 0.5%. If you don't do it with the main construction, this will never, ever get done. Have to have that thought. Ms. Sprinkle.
And what I'm reading is that this is the first step of design, right? $50 million for the design through this new entity, correct?
It's not design, it's overall economics and design.
Okay, well, I heard about $50 million.
ADA guaranteed if they do not move forward after their review, then there's a $50 million stop loss, I guess you'd call it.
Okay.
Reimbursement.
Okay, I guess what I'm saying is that this is not assuring anybody's building anything. There's still a design phase. Okay, very good.
What this says is if you build it, you're building all of it.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Ringstead.
Couple of issues. The way I read this, it's adding an in-state line, not an export line. And there's a significant difference to say, okay, we're going to do an in-state gas line, and we're going to have Fairbanks get a $200 million subsidy on a, $4 billion project, as opposed to a $200 million subsidy on a $40 billion project. If you're talking just an in-state line, the state then is going to wind up probably subsidizing. To get this kind of support, you're going to probably have to have the issue of what does the Bush want, what does Southeastern want, what does everybody else want. So this is written to say an in-state natural gas line, not an export line. The second question that I have in the way this is written, it says it must include a direct spur in the city of Fairbanks and the borough. You want a direct spur into the city? I don't think I do, but I mean, you just want to Elena. I think you need something to get into your system. You don't need it to downtown Fairbanks.
We don't necessarily need it to downtown Fairbanks. Is this live? Okay.
Yep.
Sorry, thank you. We don't necessarily need it into downtown Fairbanks. One thing that would be interesting is to read Golden Valley's a letter of support where they specifically ask for consideration to take it to North Pole because that's where they would need it.
You don't have, at this point, you don't have anything connecting into where they're at North Pole is the problem.
We do. So currently we could serve Golden Valley out of our North Pole storage site where we're neighbors there.
Right.
And in fact, when the what we call storage site 4, our North Pole storage site, was designed, it was specifically designed to potentially accommodate Golden Valley. It currently does not make economic sense for them to utilize LNG. Now, some of the prep work that IGU would have to do in order to accept pipeline gas would be to connect our North Pole to our Fairbanks systems. They are currently disconnected. And so no matter where the line goes, it's only going to go to one place. And then it's up to us at our expense to connect the two. And we're working to, we're applying for grant monies to try to do that in advance of this work.
So, I mean, the way I read this, I mean, you could interpret it, say, we want one in North Pole and one in the city of Fairbanks. I mean, we're not asking for two.
We're not.
So I think we need to, the wording is, I don't think is accurate to the intent. The other thing with the in-state line, as I understand, where Ada has been pushing the last 6 months or a year, with the idea of let's do phase one, and that's the in-state process, then they would go into the larger steps down the road and become an export. And that includes the way they presented it a couple of months ago was within their in-state proposal. You don't need to have the cleaning facility on the slope, which is very expensive. Much more so than the pipeline, and you don't need the terminal facility at the other end, which is also more expensive than the pipeline. The pipe is the cheapest part. If you're doing an in-state line, they say they were going to get the gas I'm losing the name of the organization that's doing it down by used to be Great Bear, but as I understand it, they really haven't finished that, but they've got clean gas and they don't need to clean it, which makes it substantially cheaper to get that phase one. But that is the current plan for an in-state natural gas line, which is very different than a $44 billion project. So we're mixing our terminology here, and I don't think we're being accurate or getting a clear picture of what we're trying to do. But I think if nothing else, we need to not say we really want a line to the city of Fairbanks.
Anything else? Ms. Therrien.
Thank you so much for coming. Would you be able to get us a copy of that letter from Golden Valley?
I think Danny just pulled it up.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Clayworth.
What would the diameter of this spur line be? Do you know?
12-inch. High-pressure line. We don't have a line that is as high pressure as this one would be. It'd probably be 700 PSI.
show my lack of knowledge. The gas coming off that line does not need to be processed in any way. You can extract for a direct distribution through the system.
That's what I believe Mr. Ringstad was just talking about. The process as it is currently presented for phase one would get the gas from Great Bear Pantheon, which is believed to not need any cleanup in its pipeline gas. That project, however, has not yet been commissioned.
We don't know for sure. Worst case scenario, if we don't get a spur, is there some way to offload at the pipeline itself, 35 miles away, whatever it is, and truck it in?
You would have to build or relocate a LNG facility, and that's a multi-million, if you were to build it, it's a multi-million dollar endeavor.
Well, so is the spur, right?
Sure, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Ringstad.
Just following Jerry's line of thought, the volumes that we're trying to bring in, how many trucks are you talking about to do that? I would think that would be a pretty steady flow of rigs, I would think.
It would. So it depends on what the assumption it is that you're making about how much Fairbanks is going to use, which is, from IGU's perspective, the biggest difference between what we believe and what is presented by AGDC. So currently, Interior Gas Utility uses 1.5 billion cubic feet a year, which I would have to calculate the difference in the distance, but is probably less than 1,500 trucks worth a year. Now, AGDC says that once cheaper gas shows up in our area, in a period of 3 years, our volume would grow to 11 BCF. And that is how it makes quote-unquote economic sense, because if you amortize a $180 million spur line, which is the latest number that has been announced by the entity, over 11 BCF, then you are only adding about $1.20 to the tariff as it is in the main line. Now, if you divide that, if you make the same assumption about the cost of the spur, but only assume 1.5 BCF, which is our current consumption, the tariff of the spur goes up to like $9.
Mr. Ringstad.
That's what I noticed that in your letter, and we've been kicking this around a long time. The Wood Mackenzie Group, and they're a very credible group on an international basis, but they say, according to your note here, that their numbers are run so that we you get a 90% market penetration in a 3-year period. And that's one of the fallacies we've seen in several different contexts about how many people are going to switch over to gas and how fast are they going to switch. There's a big difference between $1.50 tariff and $9 tariff. $9 tariff, nobody is going to switch, mm-hmm. right? It's going to cost you substantially more than it would with heating oil. So if you can't meet that or get close to that number and get that many people in Fairbanks to switch over, right now I don't think we've got the contractors to switch that many people in a 3-year period. But
Elena,
that drives your numbers, right?
It does. And I am a big believer in saying the words. So here's the words. You cannot get 11 BCF out of space heating in Fairbanks, even if space heating would be for Fairbanks and for Eielson. What 11 BCF means is that when they say 90% of our use would go to natural gas, and most people assume that means space heating. Now, it means, in addition to space heating, electric generation for Eielson, for Fort Wainwright, and for all of Fairbanks. So it means replacing 90% of our current generation, i.e. coal, et cetera, which would also add a significant amount of capital that is needed to build production facilities, generation facilities that can utilize that natural gas. So I do not believe that 3-year period, that will not happen in 3 years. I can go on the record for saying it will not happen.
Yeah, and that's been my concern. We're going on, we all would love to have this, but if you're gonna get to it, we need to be real and understand what we're talking about. And I've thought, yeah, 11 BCF to me is very overly optimistic, and the cost of it is not even addressed yet. And doing it in a 3-year period is probably not going to happen, even if we had the demand for it. So I think we have a long ways to go on this, but I think in terms of the legislation, we should be writing it correctly. We should support it, go forward, and let's continue to do the studies and get the, I think if a gas line goes, a main line goes, we will get gas in Fairbanks. I don't think that question has been really seriously debated for decades. The question is who's gonna pay for it and how. And we have the time to work that issue. But I think now we need to say, okay, let's get the design, let's get the engineering, let's get the data, so we can make a real decision as time comes.
Any other discussion? Ms. Therrien.
John and I go down, I'm sure we're going to talk with the sponsor and see if we can't change that language a little so that the spur provides natural gas to the Fairbanks and North Star borough as opposed to what it looks like to the city. And I think we could probably work on some language for that.
Mr. Clearworth.
No, I'm good.
Mr. Marney.
So is the borough working on this also? Same?
I have no idea. Elena.
The borough did pass a resolution to support this.
Time frame.
Mr. Sanders, could you get us a copy of that resolution? Thank you.
Okay. Less than a month ago?
Okay.
You know, this is all a complicated equation. You show support in the beginning, which I will do. And you know what? I'm going to really get excited. I'm going to ask everyone a question. Who was here on June 21st, 1977, when they turned on the gas pipeline, the oil pipeline? I'll get excited when they start ordering the pipe, because it's a 2-year project after that. But until then, I will support every endeavor to get Fairbanks gas. As such, Elena, last Saturday, I signed up my house for Fairbanks Natural Gas.
Welcome to the bright side.
Yeah. So now I get to have the expense of the change out, and I'm not going to apply for any subsidy.
Please get at least 3 quotes. That's what we tell every customer.
Okay. Anything else before we move on? Thank you for coming again to a 7 a.m. meeting and our last city council meeting. Appreciate seeing you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. So we come to the most important committee report that there is. Ms. Bell.
Good morning, Mayor and Council members. The Finance Committee is scheduled to meet on Thursday, April the 24th. We plan to continue our discussion with the Mayor's challenge of increasing revenue by 10% over the 3 years. We're planning to discuss the target-based budgeting, and we will be reviewing the first quarter report for March of 2025. That is all I have to report.
A comment, just seeing some of the perspective thoughts. You know, it's great turning loose the best of the brightest and seeing what happens. And Mr. Clearworth, Ms. Sprinkle, Mr. Ringstead, Ms. Bell, and other members of the Finance Committee, I'm looking forward to seeing your recommendations. Anything else? Okay. Mayor and City Council member comments. We're going to start out with Ms. Tidwell, because she asked a lot of questions today. As usual. Mr. Marty?
No comment.
Mr. Ringstad?
A couple of things. First, just so you know that the chief's new fees are all going to be part of our 10%.
You're not going to claim that one as yours, are you?
No, it's the committee's.
Okay.
We'll give a footnote to the boss over here. Friday, I went and testified on the SB 81, which deals with increasing the cap on the PERS and TERS 22%. And it was the Senate Labor and Commerce. It's Bert Stedman's bill. And Bert initially spent, I think, more time than the testimony, two of us testified. But as he laid this thing out, it was interesting to see his discussion. And he's looking at it from the perspective of this debt that we have to our retirement system. Instead of going down like it was designed 15 or 20 years ago, we eventually would work our way out of this. He says, we're not only not getting it paid off, the last few years the debt has been growing again and growing significantly. It's up $250 million in the last few years, and I think a number he said was $81 million this year. I might be off on that number, but he very specifically addressed the issue of this. The state system is set up where the ARM board, and this is a memory quiz, but it's the Alaska Retirement something or other board. I don't remember the acronym for it, but it's a group that goes in, they hire their actuarials, the people come in, run their numbers and say, here's what we think is going to happen. So they set the rates and the amounts that are supposed to be contributed every year. Going back a couple of decades, that was clearly failing. They were the actuarial. Some folks in the legislature thought fairly strongly that they just blew their actuarial, and they wound up saying the markets are going to do great. You don't have to pay as much, so we underpaid for a few years. Then you come back and say, okay, we got a fix, and now we're going back into it. He said that we've seen this trend for the last several years, and the ARM board really has done nothing. He was very politely trying to say we have to change the policy. He went so far as to say a couple of times he hopes with this legislation this will start an active debate and discussion on how we're going to manage our way out of this, because we have to do something and make some changes. And I was really pleased because he addressed and initially talked about what was happening years ago, and Fairbanks was the example. He said that the debt that was coming at Fairbanks was going to bankrupt them. And he says local governors, small communities cannot afford to pay more. They're paying way too much now. And toward the end of his comments, he said that we need to have this discussion. We need to have be giving more advice, comments to the ARM board in their process, and the municipality should have a seat at the table, which to me was wonderful that's where he's going. I testified on behalf of the city saying, ours is looking at, I think I said it's approaching $1 million, it's $800,000+ a year. We can't afford to keep doing this. We wanted to work with whoever tried to make this out. So I was trying to lay the groundwork that yes, the municipalities want to be a seat at the table here. The other person to testify was Lisa Parker on behalf of Municipal League. Lisa's out of Soldotna, Kenai area, and they were a little stronger from their position, saying, this bill just can't do this, and just leave it open ended for the cities. The committee took no action. Senator Stedman didn't even request that they take action. He wants the discussion, and he wants to have a solution made, as opposed to just getting his bill passed. So that was good. The second thing that's then coming along that we saw, I guess it was yesterday, Marguerite and I talked a little bit, SB 55, another one dealing with retirement systems, and I think they had a hearing this, or they're having a hearing in an hour on this bill. But we need to take a look at it. I think it moved out of the first committee and is now having a hearing in Senate Finance. So we probably want to be prepared to say something when we're down there next week on SB 55. And it has to do, I think, as I understand it, which is, I haven't spent much time on it yet, for the employees that, public employees that didn't go in, that came out of the Social Security system, what we do with those and how we go about getting them back into a system like that. And in the comments and the notes that I saw that I think were from the Municipal League, they were very concerned about it because as an employer, if we go back in, then the employer has to pay the 6.5%, just like the employer does on Social Security, which is 6.5% if we got to pay that to all of them. Margarita's not sure if how many employees we have would fall into that category, but that is a big concern because that'll be a big hit. I mean, take 6.5% on top of our payroll, 6.5%. That's a significant amount of money to us. So we need to do some homework on that and try and figure that out and at least plant some seeds next week that we have concerns.
Ms. Sprinkle, are you wanting comments of yourself or a discussion with John?
Mm-hmm. If he has any comments to what we've just heard, what's his boots on the ground thought?
Yuri?
Can you hear us?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, now I can. Thoughts about the two bills that Mr. Ringstad brought up. Senate Bill 81 is really kind of a shot across the bow because of the momentum behind the bills in both majorities to move back to defined benefit systems. Senate Bill 55 is really an optional method for bringing in folks to a supplemental benefit program like the state's SBS program or another 401k style program for those who are don't benefit from that today. And really the target on Senate Bill 55 is the teacher's retirement system. Many teachers do not have access to a supplemental benefit program or Social Security. So that's the target there. But I'll be sure and provide both Ms. Therrien and Mr. Ringstad a summary of that, and we'll be prepared to talk about that when they're here next week.
Okay. Ms. Sprinkle.
I'm good. I'm dry.
Ms. Therrien.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about that the review we had with regard to the alcohol licensing and our discussion that we had. And basically, what we kind of decided after talking with Mr. Chard and Dispatch Mike was that we would like to skip the list, have the mayor make a recommendation because it's in the code as to whether or not we need to object, and to have the departments provide information because the chief of police and dispatch probably knows more about the problem liquor places than anybody in the city. Of course, all the departments can still weigh in. Christy felt that her department really knows the problem areas. So we'd like to have Christie's department become one of the people that make recommendations to us. And we also thought that increasing the list is not going to really improve things, because the state board is only going to look at whether or not they pay their taxes and whether or not they're licensed. They also thought that we might want to, if, for example, that a license was coming up, the timeline had already expired, there are citizens that are concerned that we might want to do a recess on a license so that the next meeting other people could testify. And if we needed to provide findings of fact to object to a license, that we would have that time. And there is only about, out of the 100 licenses, there's only been two that really had a problem. And we also are going to maybe spell out in the code a process for protest so that that's more clear. And the clerk's report would provide all of that information to us. And we also suggested that because the list is so subjective as to whether or not it really was alcohol related, whether the person had drunk at that establishment or been somewhere else, to just let the police department and fire and the mayor and the other departments make those decisions as to whether or not we need to have that list, which we felt was really not helpful. Yes, and I was gonna try to go down to AMCO and Juno, but I guess they don't have an office there, so maybe we'll do something. And we also wanted to let community and economic development and the House DCRA, let them know that we're real concerned that AMCO doesn't have the resources and the funding to get this information to us. That's why we had all those liquor licenses get approved without really having any hearings. So we're hoping that maybe they're catching up. And if there's a owner that doesn't come to the meeting and there's other people that are testifying against them, that maybe the council would give them the courtesy of postponing it. Did I get all that? Danny?
I think so.
Okay. So we're going to, our attorney is going to work on some changes to the code, and then we're going to get together again, look at that, and then present it to the council. But we wanted to get a sense of the council as to how you feel about that.
Ms. Sprinkle.
Thank you for all the work. That sounds amazing. And I really look forward to seeing this eliminating of a list that doesn't help us become something more substantial from departments who actually do something about it. So that's right. A smart idea. Thank you.
And one final thing, Mr. Ringstad's concern that there are so many problems going on with a specific facility is something different from getting the list, but that we need to look at how to deal with that as well, not necessarily with regard to the licensing, but as another aspect. And we'll probably look into that a little bit too.
Mr. Clayworth.
Has another date been set?
Not yet, because we're working for the attorney, waiting for the attorney to get some work done.
Just a couple quick comments. Speaking of an arm board, I looked at the membership of that one time, and everyone on that board was either a recipient of it or going to be a recipient of it. In the retirement, I thought, why would you make up a board of all those who gain from it? But that's how it was back when it went belly up, the thing. It's good to see the News Minor editorial on Sunday. Coming out strongly against going back into another DB program. I appreciated that a lot. On this trip, I stopped in Las Vegas and visited a friend who runs an ambulance company. And in Las Vegas, they do things a little different. They have a city and they have their fire department, but they let out franchises for ambulance service to different companies in the area. And you get a long-term lease with them. In his ambulance company, he had 100 ambulances. And I was having fun looking at the boneyard where the ones that were wrecked or whatever, and one of them was a Mercedes. I thought that was interesting. But they get these long-term leases, and his problem was getting these long-term leases so that they know how much investment that they can put into it. He wants to build a new facility, but to do that and to amortize it out and be cost-effective, he had to have, I think, a 20 or 25-year lease, and he was at council that night trying to get that. I don't know if he got it or not, but it's a very different system, and they have certain geographic areas where these so-called franchises operate. And I share that with you. It's a very different methodology than what we do here. Anyway, had fun. Thank you.
Well, first of all, Mr. Clayworth, usually people go to Las Vegas for a whole different thought. But we're talking about Mr. Clayworth.
I spent not a nickel in the casino, but I did at an Italian restaurant in a casino. Is that pretty good?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I would have done, too.
Jerry, we're more alike than you think. When I went to Vegas, I didn't spend a penny on gambling either.
Okay, a couple things. John and... Valerie, let's have a good discussion in regards to the outstanding balance of our defined benefit. I've got some thoughts on that that might be interesting, and send it down with you. Mr. Engstead, every time you come in, you bring a part of history with that, Pepsi-Cola. And this reminds me of old Fairbanks, and I thank you for that. Had a very good and certainly get an exciting meeting in regards to the changeouts of Golden Heart Plaza that we're looking at. And I'd say we should be able to give you a presentation of what will be happening down there by early May. And, you know, my thoughts are is we're going to make it a stop for people. If you're from Fairbanks, you're going to want to bring your guests down there. If you're a visitor of Fairbanks, this is something you're going to want to visit. And that's what I'm looking at. Ms. Tidwell.
I just have a question for you that reminds me of something. I had seen, did we not get any bids for somebody to install the Portland Loo? Is that going back out?
Mr. Sanders.
I will have to check on that because I thought that one was already.
Yeah, that one was rebid and redone, and yeah. But we'll have Bob Pristash write a letter and telling everyone the schedule of that and sending it to the council.
Okay, perfect.
So anyway, it's going to get interesting down there. I think that overall, the downtown Fairbanks will be operated very well this summer with everything that we're doing and the investments that you've put into it. So I thank you for it. And with that, our next meeting is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025 at 7 a.m. I will be in Anchorage for the infrastructure meeting. So Mr. Clayworth will be running the Tuesday, 22nd work session meeting. Yes.
Mayor, you said that you might want to talk to me and John about,
yes.
And when did you want to try to do that?
When's our next meeting with Yuri? Is it before
you're
going? Okay.
Tomorrow at 3. Right,
okay.
Yuri? Oh, I think he's gone.
Yeah.
Tomorrow at 3.
So
okay.
just some ideas.
Okay.
And we're adjourned.